Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It's March 21st, 2017. Welcome, everyone.
I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment. And I need to do a little bit of housekeeping here. I'm rescheduling the public hearing on House Bill 2020 to Monday, March 27th, 2017.
You're always carrying bills over. Boy.
We have a lot of work
Can't
to do
you finish
over the house.
Okay.
Tonight we have two sets of informational meetings. The first will be an overview of the Associated Oregon Industries report, the Oregon Cap and Trade Analysis of Economic Impacts of Senate Bill 1574. And I'll let those folks explain the scope of their analysis and when they get up there here. So I'd like to invite up Mike Friess, Joel Fisher, and Ken Ditzel?
Ditzel.
Come on up.
Chair Helm, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher on behalf of Oregon Business Association and Associated Oregon Industries. Our two associations have started the process of joining forces. We're creating a new business association that will take shape later this year in July. And for the time being, although we are retaining our two identities, we are operating off of one shared legislative agenda, singing the same song on all issues all session long. We represent together over 1,700 businesses all across Oregon, in every corner of the state, large and small, and every size in between. We believe that a healthy environment and a healthy economy go hand in hand. We value environmental policies that balance the needs of new economies and traditional sectors and are sensitive to both rural Oregonians and those who live in cities. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear this presentation, and I'm going to turn over to Mike, who will say a few words and then introduce our guest.
Thank you, Chair Helm, Chair Dembro, members of the committee work group. Thank you for having us here to present. This has been a topic of conversation, not only in this building, but certainly within the business community. And we wanted to take an opportunity to start to learn about what the impacts are to not only Oregon's economy, but what different regions and how they're impacted and what different business sectors are impacted. So we had a number of members who kindly donated money over the summer, and we went out and we did a national search to find a firm that can help us understand the macroeconomic impacts of cap and trade. And the bill at the time that we reviewed was Senate Bill 1574. And so that's what the analysis will cover. We were really fortunate to find FTI. They've been a great group to work with. They've helped educate us in the business community and understand how these different policies interact with one another, and we're really excited about this report, and we hope you find it useful. And I think what you'll identify is that there are still some remaining issues that will require additional analysis, and that's okay. We understand that, and we look forward to working with folks as we continue around this discussion. But we're really here to hear from Ken and about the report, so I'm just going to leave it there.
So welcome very much. But before you get started, I just want to tell people who are viewing this online that that the report from FTI, as well as this slide deck that we'll be following, is available on our meeting materials section of today's agenda. So welcome you to look at that, as well as all the other meeting materials. So welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Helm, Chair Dembro, committee members. Thanks for having me today. I want to give a special thanks to my co-authors of the report, Scott Nystrom and Evan Klein as well. My name is Ken Ditzel. I lead our economic impacts group at FTI Consulting. Our group mainly focuses on energy investments and policies and their impact both at the state and national and county level. We use energy market models along with macroeconomic models to analyze these impacts. I'm going to be speaking to you today about SB 1574 and the economic impacts of such a proposal. To begin, I'll be speaking about a little background on our project with AOI, also a little bit about FTI Consulting. I'll be giving you a summary of SB 1574. I will then discuss assumptions and modeling approaches and how we are similar and somewhat different from the DEQ. I'll then discuss our major findings, and then finally, I'll touch on the family of four analysis, which looks at the cost of living impacts from our study.
And Ken, before you get started, would you prefer that we hold our questions till the end, or as you're going along, as you prefer?
Sure. I will try to keep this to less than 30 minutes, if that's okay, and then questions at the end?
Great.
Great. Thanks. Good. To begin, I'll give you a little background. The Oregon Senate and the House have made a number of proposals over the year to reduce emissions from greenhouse gases to 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. The Associated Oregon Industries, or AOI, engaged FTI Consulting to study the state level, regional, sub-regional level impacts to residential, commercial, and manufacturing sectors if a policy like SB 1574 were implemented. It's important to remember there are a number of complementary programs already in place in Oregon that help to reduce greenhouse gas emissions going forward. Those programs include the Clean Fuels Program, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, closure of Boardman, and a ban on coal-fired imports starting in 2031. These complementary policies do have costs, but we do not analyze their costs in our study. Instead, we embed them into the baseline scenario that we look at, and then we look only at the incremental cost of a policy like SB 1574. We also do not account for emissions leakage. Emissions leakage is when emissions leave the state to other states or internationally because industries or population are pushed out of the state due to higher costs, and that is not included in our analysis. Just quickly touching on FTI. FTI is a global consultancy with 3,600 professionals focusing on economic and management consulting. We're in over 29 countries with deep expertise across a number of economic sectors. Our group, the Economic Impacts Group, sits within our energy, power, and products practice. So moving on to a summary of SB 1574. As I had mentioned, SB 1574 aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. A majority of those emissions would be covered, so not all of the emissions, and those covered would be entities that are producing 25,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent annually. There are other sectors that would not be covered or only partially covered. The program would start in 2021 and continue through 2050. Covered entities, in order to comply with the program and to offset their emissions, would have to purchase credits or allowances at auctions. We assumed 100% auction in this case, in these scenarios. They could also then purchase them bilaterally or with each other or through secondary markets like brokered markets. We closely followed SB 1574 with one exception, and that exception being offsets. In our cap-and-trade scenario, we assumed no offsets. Offsets sometimes can be contentious because they're hard to measure or to be verified. There's also issues around offsets not directly reducing emissions from point sources and allowing those point sources to continue emitting. So we didn't look at the macroeconomic impact of offsets. We did do a sensitivity analysis, though, on what offsets, very cheap offsets, in fact, we assume $0 for the cost of the offsets, would do to the price. We did not run that price effect through our modeling. There were other major provisions in SB 1574 that we modeled, in particular three. For one, the allocation of allowances to emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries. We assumed that these industries would get some allocation per the bill. We also assumed that there would be a consignment of allowances to utilities to help offset those low-income customers facing higher energy prices from the proposal. And then finally, we dispersed the remaining revenues from the auction to two funds, the first being the State Highway Fund. We assumed 85% of the remaining revenues would go to that fund per the proposal, and then the remaining 15% to the Just Transitions Fund. Now, this chart helps put into context just what it means to reduce your emissions to 75% below 1990 levels. The first phase of the program is a reduction of 20% below 1990 levels by 2025. If you were to look at U.S. emissions over time that I have plotted on this chart, you'll see that to achieve that reduction, you would have to move back to 1969 levels of emissions. Then moving to 45% below 1990 levels by 2035, that would mean moving back to 1956 level of emissions. And then finally moving back to 75% below 1990 levels by 2050, that's equivalent to 1907 levels of emissions. I believe this chart is important because as you're reducing your emissions back to essentially historical values, at the end of the program will be 150 years from 2050 to approximately to 1907, your economy has grown significantly since then. So you have a growing economy, but you're reducing emissions, and that's a tough challenge to face. Next, I want to touch on some of the similarities and differences between DEQ and FTI and our assumptions and how we actually went about modeling the cap and trade program. Many of our assumptions or input assumptions on the FTI side and what I call the underlying assumptions on the DEQ side were quite similar. On natural gas prices, we're very similar, just a difference in 1 year from the Energy Information Administration's annual energy outlook, a very minor difference in gas prices. Our Oregon load forecast, we assume to be flat. Oregon's load has been flat for a number of years, and we assume that going forward per the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. It appeared to us that DEQ had a similar assumption. Assumptions that were the same were the renewable portfolio standard, the imports of coal-fired power, the closure of Boardman. It's not clear to us whether or not DEQ assumed the closure of plants outside of Oregon, which are important to overall emissions in the Western Interconnect, those being Centralia and Colstrip. We also assumed a tax on new gas-fired combined cycles. Wasn't clear to us whether or not DEQ assumed this or not, but the difference was minor nonetheless. And then finally, we assumed the Clean Power Plan, particularly the new source complement part of it, which would include both existing and new generators, having to reduce emissions to 8.1 million tons by 2030. But overall, our electricity market assumptions were quite similar. And then on our other major assumptions, we both assume the Clean Fuels Program in terms of Oregon fuel consumption going forward. Our use of the AEO 2017 show a lower level of fuel consumption going forward than the AEO 2016. That means less carbon emissions going forward in the future from the transportation and the natural gas sectors. GDP growth and population growth came from our REMI tool that we used, and also some Oregon agency forecasts. On the PHEV and electric vehicle side, DEQ had some very specific assumptions. We didn't mirror those assumptions at the granular level that they had, but we did have price elasticity of demand such that as allowance prices increase, that would increase transportation fuel increases, or to increase transportation fuel prices, which would reduce demand for fossil-based transportation fuels. Both DEQ and FTI assume some type of loss factor, representing losses due to overhead administration and some out-of-state entities receiving some of the benefits from the allowances as they're dispersed through the different programs. The big difference, though, between our approaches is in how we actually modeled things. The chart at the bottom of the slide really kind of tells it all. DEQ looked at 1 year. We instead looked at 34 years, 2017 through 2050. DEQ modeled all of Oregon. We modeled all of Oregon plus eight subregions. In our electricity market model, we modeled the entire Western Interconnect. What that means is from the Rocky Mountains to the West Coast, U.S. and Canada, every single unit, transmission constraints from 2017 to 2050 under this program. So we had a highly detailed electricity market model. We also used a macroeconomic model that we consider dynamic, meaning that it's forward-looking and also has a price response to it, whereas the DEQ model was static and looked at just 1 year. So there was no price response at all in the DEQ model, meaning that as prices go up, consumers don't react to those prices in their model. Our model has that reaction and solves for the least cost solution. And then finally, I think most importantly is we developed CO2 prices from our modeling. So the integration of our Plexus electricity model, our CTAM model, which looks at gaseous fuels and transportation fuels together, were iterated and run until we got a carbon price that converged to an acceptable level. And then we took that CO2 price and ran it through the REMI model, which is a macroeconomic model, the one that I described that is very much dynamic and forward-looking and has price responses. So quite a big difference in how we approach the modeling. In terms of the sub-regions, we mapped out eight sub-regions within Oregon and looked at the macroeconomic impacts, both GDP and jobs, within each of these regions. And we align the regions mainly along MSAs or metropolitan statistical areas, but we also factored in some of the utility service areas so that we could translate the price impacts in Plexos on the electricity side back to specific utilities and show that in our macroeconomic analysis. So one of the first things we did, we took all these inputs, put them in our model, ran the model, and created what we call a baseline scenario. In our baseline scenario, we show both in this chart both uncapped emissions and capped emissions. Uncapped emissions in our analysis is the light blue line, so that's total emissions, and the light blue dotted line is the capped emissions. And as you can see, our light blue solid line differs markedly from the solid purple line of the DEQ, the reason being that our models show a lot of price response or a lot of response to the complementary policies that you already have in place in Oregon, meaning that Boardman closes, you have the clean fuel program, no coal imports. And then going forward after 2030, our baseline is much lower as well because we rely on the AEO 2017, which has lower fuel demand than the AEO 2016. Now, the dotted lines represent the emissions that have to be reduced under the cap. So when you're when we're going forward, let's think about that is the level at which or that is the level at which the baseline emissions sit and need to be reduced in the cap and trade scenario. So what are the major findings from our study when we run the cap and trade scenario? Well, we find that greenhouse gas allowance prices remain below $100 per ton roughly through 2035. What you see is a slow beginning to allowance prices as the policy takes off. It then ramps up through 2030. After 2030, you see a big decline. That's because you shut off coal imports coming into the state. That reduces pressure on the cap and lowers prices. Through 2035, we hit $84 a ton. That is between the two price input assumptions that DEQ assumed for 2035. They assumed $32 per ton and $89 per ton. You achieve a lot of reductions, particularly from the electricity sector through 2030, 2035. And then you kind of see this hockey stick price jump that occurs. And that is mainly because you have less elastic sectors that need to reduce their emissions, particularly the transportation fuel sector and the home heating and commercial heating, space heating sectors, switching from gaseous fuels to electricity. Now, in terms of whether or not our prices were reasonable, we went back and looked at other reports that examined emission reductions at a similar level, and we found that an analysis by SAIC showed $400 to $500 per ton to meet Waxman market level reductions, which is similar to 75% below 1990 levels. And similarly, a NAM study, or National Association of Manufacturers, found that you'd have to have a $1,000 carbon tax in order to meet Waxman market level reductions, which SB 1574 is attempting to achieve. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about cost containment and cost containment mechanisms that would lower the prices, but we can touch on that maybe a little bit later. In terms of baseline scenario emissions, looking at the right chart, you'll see that the electricity sector, which is the light blue bar, is greatly reduced between 2030 and 2035. It's a significant reduction. We squeeze out the electricity sector because it's the most elastic sector. What's left after that is the transportation fuels and gaseous fuel sector, and they are reduced by about half of their 2035 values by 2050. These charts are showing total uncapped emissions as opposed to capped emissions. So you see about a 60% reduction in capped emissions by 2050. What's the macroeconomic impact? The DEQ found that in 2035, there would be a GDP lost opportunity of $203 million or a $282 million gain. We actually found that there would be a $1.3 billion loss to the Oregon economy. Portland is mostly impacted because that's where most of the population sits. These charts show a little bit more detail in terms of the impacts on a year-by-year basis. The red dotted lines are Oregon. The left chart shows the absolute change in GDP, and then the right chart shows the percent change in GDP by region. For some of the smaller regions and more of the rural areas, there can actually be an economic benefit to the cap and trade program. But for the majority of Oregonians, there's an economic cost to such a program under SB 1574. You see a similar effect with jobs. It mirrors the GDP charts that you previously saw. And in both the GDP and jobs charts, you can kind of think of them as inverses of the carbon allowance chart, where you see carbon allowance prices going up, coming down around 2030 and going back up. You see the mirror image here on jobs and GDP. By 2050, our models predict about a 17,000 job loss in the state of Oregon.
And Ken, I'm sorry to jump in, but when you talk about loss, you're talking about loss from what could have been.
That's correct.
It's not loss from where we are now.
That's right. It's both a loss from the baseline analysis. So you still have economic growth, and both just going back by one, two charts, the overall reduction in 2035 of GDP is about 0.4% from the baseline. So you still have economic growth. You just lose job opportunity and GDP opportunity, which translates also into tax revenue opportunity. Now, how does it impact certain sectors? Well, because of the cap and trade, there's a lot of turnover and need to comply, which means there's a lot of construction that's needed, new investment. So the construction industry benefits both on a GDP basis and on a jobs basis, but that's more than offset by losses in other sectors, particularly the manufacturing sector, which experiences a $271 million GDP loss in 2035. The net losses, again, are $1.3 billion in 2035 for GDP and almost 5,000 in jobs in 2035. Now, if we break this down even further and look at manufacturing, we'll see that over 90% of the manufacturing subsectors are negatively impacted by this proposal. In particular, the biggest subsector, computer and electronics, sees almost $150 million loss in output being sales. Now, you'll see one little blip at the very end, and that's the non-metallic minerals. That sector actually gets a bounce up because of the construction industry and represents sandstone and gravel. Next, I'm going to go into the family of four analysis and the cost impacts. We took a step further beyond the macroeconomic impacts to understand, well, what would a family of four, typical household, which has less than three people per unit in Oregon, what would be their price impacts or cost impacts? And we had to analyze this across the electricity sector, gas, natural gas, and transportation fuels. And this chart shows the impacts across the different utilities from the baseline in terms of having to comply with the cap and trade policy. And you'll see on the residential side, PacifiCorp in particular, because they have so many assets out of state and many of them fossil-based, reaching almost 90% rate increase by 2050 over the baseline. Idaho Power is in a similar situation. Most of its assets are out of state, and most of those assets being fossil-based. PGE is less impacted because of its portfolio within the state. And then finally, EWEB is the least impacted because it's almost 100% zero carbon generation portfolio. In terms of gasoline prices, our forecast in the cap and trade scenario is that prices reach $7.50 per gallon relative to almost $4 per gallon in 2050. And that natural gas prices, because of the high allowance price, reach almost 180% above the baseline. Now, when you take the price impacts from the electricity side, natural gas side, and transportation fuel side, and put them together and do a cost of living impact for across the family of four, you'll see that by 2050, the impact or the cost to a typical family is about $2,500. This is on average across Oregon. It varies quite a bit, as you can see from the chart, almost up to $3,000. For one area and almost $1,500 for another. And the reason for this large spread mainly has to do with where the subregions that we have modeled lie according to the different utilities. So there's a different electric utility impact, as I showed you earlier, for EWEB, PacifiCorp, PGE, and Idaho Power, and that creates a lot of variability in electricity prices and thus a lot of variability in the cost of living for the family of four. So at this point, I'll close my presentation and open up to questions.
Questions from the committee. Representative Roxman.
Thank you.
On this slide, Mike, the dramatic increase from 2020 to, and then it starts dipping down in 2032, where is that increase coming from?
From 2020 to 2032 or 2030?
Yeah.
Well, the policy begins in 2021. So we start at zero in 2020. And then in order to comply with the cap, allowance prices start creeping up to force emission reductions. Those allowance prices then get translated into costs that are passed down to consumers in terms of higher gasoline prices, electricity prices, and natural gas prices.
Thank you.
Other questions, committee? Senator Robel.
So, again, I'll stay with this chart. $2,500 average increase. Is that on today's dollars, or is that inflation-driven as well?
That's $2,016. All the numbers that we show here are in $2,016.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you. So your findings are different than DEQ's. Why is that, and why are your results, I guess, more accurate?
Well, I'll say that our findings are much different, mainly because we use a different set of models. We use very similar assumptions, but our models are more dynamic and longer term and have this price response that the DEQ models don't have, particularly on the electricity side. We model every single unit within the Western Interconnect, as I said, out through 2050. It allows for new builds, retirements, and it meets all the other major provisions across the Western Interconnect, renewable portfolio standards, AB 32 in California, et cetera. And then our CTAM model also covers the gaseous fuels sector and transportation fuel sector in a lot of detail. And then finally, the REMI model looks forward out to 2050. It's a dynamic price response model. That drives a lot of the differences.
I guess the soundbite that stuck in my mind early in your presentation was that fully implemented, we would be mimicking the economy in 1907.
Well, it would be the emissions at 1907. Emissions level. Yeah.
That, yeah, I hadn't heard it characterized that way before, but that's a great soundbite.
Further questions? Representative Holby.
Yeah, I'm curious when, you know, thinking about the jobs and all this, does your model anticipate that there's any reinvestment of the monies from cap and trade back into clean energy, for example? Or, I mean, I'm just curious how that works.
Sure. I will go back to the slide that talks a little bit about that and gives a little bit more detail on some of the major provisions that recycle the auction revenues. It's important to understand that our models didn't look just at the cost side. There are some benefits in the cap and trade in terms of the turnover. You saw that in the construction industry. There's reinvestments. So we look at the new investments in solar and wind, et cetera, that do have a positive impact on the economy. But what we found is a net cost. So when you look at the absolute cost and the absolute benefits, put them together, what we found is a net cost. In terms of how we treated reinvestment, we followed SB 1574 very closely. So SB 1574 states that 85% of the remaining auction revenues go into the state highway fund. We apply that. We assume that it goes into construction materials and labor, and that does have a benefit, but those benefits are then wiped out by the overall cost of the program. So there is reinvestment that we have in our modeling. We don't ignore that, but the net cost from the benefit cost analysis shows that there's an overall cost to the economy.
Follow up. Thanks for that. So how does that compare to AB 32, 1547, where you have so much going into the state highway fund? I don't think that's quite the experience in AB 32 in California.
I'd have to go back and look exactly how California goes back and disperses its auction revenues. I think it's through a lot of different mechanisms. Putting 85% in the state highway fund is a large amount. It's called a cap and invest, as opposed to a cap and rebate, where you might rebate some of the funds to consumers and affected parties.
Representative Power.
So I thought I heard you say that the difference between the study outcome and DEQ study outcome is not based on any of the assumptions. It's based on purely the different nuanced models, correct?
You know, a number of our assumptions are very similar, okay. Particularly the very important assumptions. DEQ actually didn't take their assumptions and really input them into their model. They kind of supported their modeling with these assumptions, and by that I mean they outlined what they were going to use, and particularly on the electricity sector, and then they inputted a third party CO2 price. Now they did use some of their assumptions on the that's the transportation fuel sector and the gaseous fuel sector, but for the most part their assumptions were kind of underlying assumptions to support the CO2 price trajectories that they used to then apply into their in-plan modeling.
Other questions? Follow-up?
Can I ask a follow-up? Mm-hmm. Different question, but does your model take into account any avoided costs on the basis of health impacts that are no longer being suffered by a family? If not, are there any emerging models that do?
That's a very good question. Our model does not look at impacts of health or any other impacts that one might foresee or project from potential climate change temperature increases. So we don't look at those type of impacts. But we still look at a net benefit cost analysis on the economic side. So it's purely an economic analysis, and it doesn't have some of more of these intangibles that in some studies are economically documented. In terms of studies that project forward these benefits, I would have to get back to you on those.
Okay, that'd be great.
Senator Robel.
So at the beginning of the slide, you said that DEQ's model was just 1 year?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. They looked at 2035.
Okay. So that's just 1 year. How close to 2035 and to your 2035? Were they still fairly far off?
In fact, ours was pretty close in 2035 for the CO2 prices, not the macroeconomic impacts. But we were close to their high input assumption. They assumed $89 per a California CEC price projection, and on the low side they assumed 32. So we were within that band of what they assumed. 2035 is an interesting year to choose, mainly because it comes right after, it's only 5 years after 2030 when you get the coal import ban. So you've depressed prices quite a bit during that period. So there's a lot of turmoil between 2030 and 2035 after that ban, and then you get on that hockey stick projection.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So DEQ projected that in 2035, they were looking at a plus or minus effect on the economy, and they said that the effect could be 1% decline in the economy, in the GDP, and you're suggesting a 0.4%. So it's within the ballpark. I mean, it's within the realm of what they're projecting now.
In terms of the overall impact, they correct me if I'm wrong. As you said, I think they projected a 1% impact, and we projected about a 0.4% impact in 2035.
So I appreciate that you based this on Senate Bill 1574, which was the starting point. It makes perfect sense. But we're trying to come up with a program here that is that builds on 1574 and does include elements such as, you know, linking to the Western Climate Initiative, having the ability to bank allowances and have different cost containment possibilities, offsets, you know, as you mentioned. And so, I mean, in a sense, what you're showing us is what we should not do, right? And so, you know, as I look at your report, and I find a lot of valuable information in it, because it's showing us some of the things that we really need to make sure to include these particular elements, making sure that we connect, and that this is not the opinion necessarily of the committee, but this is where I'm getting to, that we need to connect to other jurisdictions, that we need to have a larger allowance market, auction market, banking, those kinds of things. Well, I realize it's kind of speculative, but what would the projections look like if we did include those elements?
Sure. The only cost containment mechanism that we did take a look at was offsets, and we assumed up to 8% offsets, similar to California. And the price impact from assuming that those offsets at $0, that they're costless offsets, which is very conservative, would be a 44% price reduction over the on average over the horizon. So offsets could be one mechanism for containing costs if you're comfortable with what offsets do. We did not study linking other programs together. Certainly, that would have some benefits in terms of opening up the market and allowing for more trading and more possibilities to reduce things in a cost-effective manner. Ceiling prices are also another mechanism for keeping costs contained as well. Those are types of provisions that could be studied, but we did not study in our analysis.
So we'll talk to AOI and OBA about perhaps funding a subsequent study that would include those. Yes? Thumbs up?
Are you actually looking for an answer?
No. I do have another question, and that's, you know, sort of the role of, I mean, the influence of technology as you're looking down the model. You know, obviously, as you're getting past 2035, things get kind of very iffy about where our technology will be that can bring our emissions levels down and perhaps bring costs down. And so I'm wondering, for example, in your 2035 estimate, what were you thinking of in terms of the percentage of our automobile fleet that would be electrified?
Sure. I'll touch on that, and then also on the electric sector. On the transportation fuel side, we used the top-down model, CTAM, which looks at fuel consumption by sector, and the price elasticity as is a response to higher prices. We did not have a granular bottom-up type model that looked at electric vehicle penetration. Now, you can take the results from our modeling and say that there's a certain amount of vehicle miles traveled and there's fossil fuel reduction, and then compute from there what's replacing that, and it would most likely have to be PHEVs or electric vehicles, and then understand what that penetration would be. So you could kind of back calculate that from our top down approach. But we did not show that or document that. And then in terms of technology progression going forward on the electricity sector, we assume that solar would experience about a 25% decline in cost from now through about 2025. And then on the wind side, there's costs that we assume are incur or cost reductions that occur because of continued market penetration, economies of scale from the ITC, and then it kind of flatlines from there. And there's different reasons why we have around that flatlining being NIMBY and transmission constraints for the wind.
Representative Bentz.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. A very interesting report.
Is there a your slide that shows the GHG emissions baseline scenario? Is there a slide here that shows us the actual good that the system does for us, the actual amount of GHG reduction that we get, assuming with your assumptions? What should I be looking
sure.
at?
Sure. This slide here, slide 16. Gives you both the baseline and the scenario reductions. This is total emissions, so uncapped total emissions. It's not just capped emissions. So we're Oregon is at approximately 60 million metric tons of CO2 emissions now. We project that in the baseline in 2021, but in the scenario, we see that total emissions decline to about 22 million. Metric tons of CO2 equivalent. That's approximately a 60% reduction, because it's a 60% reduction from total emissions, not capped emissions. You still achieve the 75% reduction for the capped emissions.
And follow up. And if you could go back to your previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right there. So does that those reductions assume that higher price? Mm-hmm. Is that a correct statement?
Or another way of restating it might be that these prices create those reductions.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes.
That's a much better way of saying it. Mm-hmm.
Follow up.
If one were to implement those protections that were alluded to earlier, then we don't get the reductions. Because without the price signal sent by the hockey stick, then reductions don't occur. So at least that's been my understanding from discussions I've had on the low carbon fuel standard, that unless there's an incredibly high price, you don't get the reductions. So if we do step in and adjust things, as like I said was alluded to earlier, then I'm just trying to figure out what that does. Does it shove us out further, or what happens to if we put the protections in to avoid these incredibly high prices? We don't get the reductions. It's that simple, isn't it?
That's correct. Under the assumptions that we put into the model, that if you don't use these price, or if these prices aren't applied, you don't get those reductions.
Yeah.
Any kind of mechanism to mitigate high prices would allow for higher emissions. Under different sets of technology assumptions, et cetera, that could change things. But according to the input assumptions that we used, you can't get these reductions unless you see these high prices.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back. I'll be back to you. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. So I'm struck by, obviously, the long-term model that you've given us, 35 years out, and yet when I think about the next 35 years, what I realize is everything that we don't know. We're making certain assumptions, and you've been very thoughtful about how you've incorporated those assumptions into the models. But the fact is, we would never design a program that was to last for 35 years without chunking it up in some way. There would be many points where we would stop, reconsider, adjust. So as you put this model together, is there essentially a planning threshold that makes the most sense, where we can make the most comfortable assumptions about what life will be like and within that 35-year planning period?
I think if I understand your question correctly, you're asking, instead of 35 years, is it 5 years or 10 years?
Knowing what you know and what we don't know, what planning period do you think we can actually reasonably predict out of that 35 years?
Well, it's been my experience as a consultant that you do the best in terms of making a reasonable set of predictions if you're only running one scenario. But typically you want to run a few sensitivity scenarios to understand what the different outcomes could be. A lot can change in even 10 years. So,
mm-hmm.
I really feel as if it's for all of you to find out what you're most comfortable with in terms of how far out you would take a program and want to then reevaluate it going forward. So I'm not answering your question whether it's 5 or 10, but I think it's just it's a level of comfort
Mm-hmm. But you would agree that a 35-year horizon is really speculative at the far end.
Well, I wouldn't say that our forecast is speculative, because we do make a lot of conservative assumptions in the forecast in terms of load growth, and you know there's PHE penetration and switching to electric space heating. We don't account for that, and that would drive compliance costs up even more. So there's a lot of conservative assumptions already built into this. But in terms of looking forward, I would say that one of the ways you can mitigate price increases is to have a reevaluation period every so often. That's not a bad idea.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. And that's happening in California right now, correct?
They're undergoing that process right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to Representative Johnson.
Thank you. So you gave us the overall economic analysis, but can you break it down between what happens between 2035 and 2050 when that hockey stick really kicks in? Because that looks like the most pronounced negative impact, if you will.
Sure. You know, what happens after 2035 is that you've already squeezed the reductions out of the electricity sector. And again, that's the most elastic sector, the most price responsive sector that you have. There's a lot of substitution that can go on within that sector to reduce CO2 emissions. Once you squeeze the electricity sector, what do you have left is transportation fuels, and people like to drive their cars, and you have space heating, and you need to warm your house. To switch over from a gaseous fuel, particularly in space heating, to electric heating is a high upfront cost that consumers have to experience. To incentivize them to make that switch, you have to see higher prices, and that's what happens. The higher prices help to drive the switch from gaseous fuel-based space heating to electric-based space heating, and then fossil-based transportation fuels to electricity, electric vehicles, and PHEVs.
Representative Power.
Okay, it's multiple parts in one question, so I just ask one more question and I'll be done. Have you done similar modeling for business groups in other states with this model? And if so, how have the projections turned out, and or how have states recalibrated or tailored their programs based on these results?
Sure. I have been modeling greenhouse gas programs since the Lieberman Warner Waxman Markey days when I was at Charles River Associates, and my name is on several of those reports, and that was looking at the federal level. Just last year, I was involved in a large arbitration dispute in California modeling the AB 32 program and trying to estimate what was going to happen with that program given that it was undergoing a reevaluation period in about a year. My other co-author on this report, Scott Nystrom, came to FTI from REMI. He's conducted a number of state-specific CO2 analyses in the past. So, the combination of Scott and me, we've covered a lot of ground in terms of cap and trade and CO2 policies.
One follow-up.
Yeah, sorry if my question wasn't specific. I meant about the model and its inputs and how it has made projections, and then how it has actually played out in other states, if we have that benchmark somewhere else.
If you're asking about whether or not we've used the combination of CTAM, Plexos, and REMI for another state, no, we haven't.
Okay.
We've used these models individually for different states. Scott Nystrom, who I referred to earlier, has used REMI in combination with the NEMS model, Aurora, and other electricity models. The process is really the same. You iterate, you converge to an acceptable solution, and then you input those into a macroeconomic model if it's not already integrated into the overall model.
Thanks.
Sure.
Rep Holden.
We're gonna wrap it up. Still trying to get through some of the things we were talking about, offsets a little bit. It makes me think about you didn't consider leakage either, which I think is somehow seems like it would impact, you know, the actual results of the economy in the future. Because it seems hard for us, for me to believe that we wouldn't, you know, consider leakage, because we wouldn't want to, for example, import all our cement from China. Because that would be really expensive and have a much larger, you know, imprint. And so it doesn't seem like that would be a decision that we would make. Or I would, I suppose, but maybe somebody else would. So I'm just kind of curious why leakage was left out of the assumption. And then in the allowances piece, too, I'm curious about whether you assumed that allowances could be banked, you know, because I think they're banked for in other models for 3 years. So what was your assumption around that, and, you know, what kind of impact that would have on the results?
Sure. I'll address the leakage one first. In terms of leakage, we didn't consider emissions leakage, but we did consider in the model economic leakage. So the REMI model looked at Oregon in the 8 subregions, and then it has the rest of the, you know, the U.S. wrapped around it. So it looks at the shifts and flows and transfers across those borders. In fact, it even looks at, which one thing we didn't report on, but it even forecasts population shift from this policy. So Oregonians, let's say, moving to Washington across the border to escape the higher allowance prices. And then on the banking question, we didn't consider banking in our analysis. And you're right, there are a lot of provisions out there that have banking, but that provision was not modeled.
And maybe I'll jump in here real quick. Some of the modeling that we didn't do was really a budget constraint. It wasn't that we don't think it's important. Absolute leakage for us is one of the biggest things that we want to do. Understanding offsets is something we want to do. I mean, it's all part of it, but we have a budget just like DEQ did, and we weren't able to do every kind of bell and whistle that we wanted. And so in order to have something to respond to, we just used something that was before us. So I'm sure FTI is more than capable.
We need to. Thank you so much for the presentation. I have one question before I'm going to take the chair's prerogative. Going back to the Regi States analysis, how did your analysis parse out in terms of being correct with what happened afterwards? I've got information that said that. The gloom and doom predictions of how the Regi State program would work actually didn't pan out.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with the specific study or statements that you mentioned, but with Regi, it covers only the electric sector, where this program would cover the entire economy. Also, Regi's unfortunate way was benefited by the Great Recession. So Regi was put in place before the recession occurred, expecting very high emission levels and economic growth. The recession then occurred and enabled the Regi states to more easily comply. So that's why you see pretty low prices in Regi, because simply because of the economic recession. Now, they've since tried to tighten it up a little bit. But again, that's a cap on the electric sector, and not the full economy.
Gotcha. One more question, Representative Brock Smith, and
thank
then we're going to move on.
Appreciate it. Appreciate the presentation and the stark reality of the cost to this discussion that we've been having. I'm wondering if in your model that you took into account the cost drivers of the fact that we import a lot of our timber, and of course that timber runs on trucks and rail and uses diesel and fuel to do so, or the aggregate that we use to build with, and the fact that we're importing a lot of the resources that we need to build and grow our economies rather than using the resources that we have that we can go ahead and sequester carbon within our own state in buildings for hundreds of years.
So our model does factor in the different sectors, particularly the wood and pulp and paper sectors, and has a lot of detail around how much of those sectors how much those sectors use from goods and services within the state versus what they actually import in, if I'm answering your question correctly.
Right. Follow up.
One follow up, my friend.
And so, could we bend that curve or not have it spike so high so quickly if we were utilizing more of the resources locally than importing them from?
Well, I'm guessing here, but I think you're referring to potentially offsets and reforestation. And if those were done and people had confidence in their measurability and being able to verify them, it could have a big impact on the CO2 prices. But we'd have to study that and look a little bit more closely at the some of the marginal abatement cost curves. I know the DEQ has analyzed, so I can't speak with 100% certainty that it would, but it could have a big impact.
Thank you.
And Representative, we'll be talking more about that realm next week. That's the focus, yeah. The potential impacts on rural economies.
Again, thank you for traveling to talk with us tonight. Appreciate it, and thank you all for being here.
Great.
Thanks to AOI and OBA for funding this, and we know you're going to stay engaged.
You're going to keep us engaged, I think.
Great.
At this point in our meeting tonight, we're going to, in some way, try to make contact. Are we going to with Minister Glenn Murray, the Ontario Minister of Environment and Climate? Minister Murray, welcome. This is State Representative Ken Helm, and I'm here with Senator Dembro. Thank you for making time with us tonight, despite the time change, time difference. And we understand that you've been watching our proceedings this evening, and we would welcome any advice that you might have for us and any responses to what you've heard.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman Helm. Very excited to talk to you. Oregon's been such a great friend through the Western Climate Initiative, and you I think have the most beautiful Assembly House and Senate House. That Art Deco marvel is really quite remarkable, and I've enjoyed my visits to Jasail. I'd like to tell you a little bit about. I'm just going to turn the volume down here because I'm getting a bit of feedback there. I hope you can hear me. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about where we came from and some of the similarities, because the presentation you heard, I think, gave you some good advice on how to design this, and I think it also gave some good advice on some of the things to avoid. Oregon's industry primarily come from cement manufacturing, pulp and paper, semiconductor manufacturing. So I think it'd be helpful to understand a little bit about I just want to say I've just got some feedback. Can you do anything about the feedback?
Can you try lowering the speaker volume?
Lowering the
unit.
Okay. Okay, is that better? Okay, I'm not hearing myself in echo anymore.
We
thank you. My
you.
Apologies. Can you still hear me?
Hear you.
Yes.
Okay, great. So Ontario is 75% of Canada's heavy industry. We have a very large pulp and paper and forestry industry. It's one of the dominant industries. We have the largest cement industry in Canada and one of the largest in the world. We have a very large steel industry. And we are the largest auto manufacturing center in Canada, the United States, with major operations from Ford, Honda, Toyota, Fiat Chrysler, and General Motors. We went through about a 2.5-year process looking at our whether we should use a carbon tax or cap and trade and the approaches we should take. We worked very closely with the industry, all who did their own modeling, and we did our modeling, and I shared ours with you. It was done by Enviroeconomics, Navius Research, and Dillon, which are three of the best in the cap and trade climate pricing world. And I think we sent you copies of them, and I think they're on your website, or they've been posted there. The conclusions, we were trying to get the greatest emissions reductions at the lowest price possible with the lowest negative economic impact and the strongest opportunity for job creation to seize the opportunities of a low-carbon economy. And we looked at a carbon tax and a carbon price, cap and trade. We eliminated through the research the carbon tax idea because it would involve a price upwards of $75 a ton to start off with and move up to there from there. We thought that was too expensive for our economy to absorb. We then modeled various types of cap and trade systems and pricing, and we looked at all the major systems that are in place in the world, in Europe, in Asia, South Korea, Japan, China's emerging provincial system, and we landed on the WCI model because we thought it was the most efficient, and being more North American based than our sister province of Quebec, with a similar economy, though less industrial, less heavy industry, had been using it for a number of years. We saw very stable pricing, and we saw a very strong economic performance. We did this after we closed all of our coal plants. About, in any given year, 25 to 33% of our energy, electricity rather, was generated by coal plants. We closed them over about a 7-year period. So we are in that post-coal decarbonized energy system. So the consultants you had were talking about the fact that once you deal with energy issues, that's really the low-hanging fruit. You saw that the price sensitivity was relatively low. All of our reductions now have to come from transportation. That's 35% of our emissions come from vehicles. 25% from buildings, and about 25% remaining in industry. Our industry emissions are coming down. Our energy emissions were dropped dramatically. I think it was the biggest GHG reduction in the history of North America was the closure of coal plants in Ontario. So we're into that less elastic period that you are looking at in those out years. So there was our... We looked at a number of different scenarios, and two of the biggest factors in determining what the price is like is whether you link or not. So in an unlinked market, if we did not link with California and Quebec, we would expect our carbon price would rise from this year's first year of auctions at about $18 Canadian or about $12 or $13 U.S. To $157 if we did not link with a larger market. And for those of you that were involved with the original Western Climate Initiative discussions, part of the reason WCI was formed was because unlinked markets are very expensive, especially for smaller states and smaller provinces. Linked markets provide very good price stability. So in a linked market, we would expect our carbon price on our carbon market when we link with California and Quebec next year to continue to be in that $18, $20 range in 2020 and in years out. We expect real price stability. Our cap decline rate, we cap emissions, and our decline rate, which is the rate at which we remove the allowances and the permission to pollute, is at over 4%, which is a much higher decline rate than either Quebec or California has, which really gives us the guarantee that we will achieve our reduction targets. Because of coal plant closures and large investments in solar and wind and refurbishment of part of our nuclear fleet, Our emissions are already over 6% below 1990 levels. Our target for 2020 is 15%, and our target for 2030 is 37%, and our target for 2050 is 80%. Our industries are very enthusiastic supporters of cap and trade. Our cement industry has endorsed it. We've done a lot of work with alternative fuel regulations. They're working very closely with us. They had a very unfortunate experience in British Columbia with the carbon tax, which saw leakage and the closure of cement plants. We're actually seeing massive reinvestment. St. Mary's Cement, one of our largest, has just bought up Pond Biofuels. They are recycling their carbon through algae, and they now own several startup companies in the low-carbon technology area. We have a very large mining sector. About 80% of mining finance is done through Toronto's banking system, which is we have five of the 10 largest banks in North America. We do about 80% of the world's mining finance. Goldcorp, which is one of our largest gold mining companies, is actually switching to electric vehicles, reducing their ventilation and electricity. They expect they'll be operating their mine at 2030, maybe even 40% lower than they are currently using fossil fuels, because when you remove diesel from equipment from a mine, you don't have the very expensive issues of air circulation. We're actually seeing very strong economic performance. We beat California the last 3 years. They were formerly they formerly led North America in direct foreign investment. Ontario for 3 years now has led in direct foreign investment, meaning we're attracting more capital than any other province or state. We've created over 1 million jobs in Ontario since 2008, the depths of the recession. 80% of those jobs or more are full-time, and over three-quarters are above the medium wage. So the economic performance has been quite impressive. General Motors just established their global center for autonomous vehicles here. I think the other thing, other than linking, which would be very consequential, which wasn't really modeled by the people who did that work for you, and I suggest you might want to look at global markets. There's a reason why almost everybody who's gone to cap and trade is trying to build a market. We're working with the REGI states, as they're actually some of the larger states in New England are looking at adding industry and adding transportation to electricity. And they're looking, because Quebec and Ontario are so integrated into our economies, into the New England economies, we're having some interesting conversations with them, given, I think, the success that we've had with a broader pricing system. And the other piece is that you want to do this sooner than later. We're hoping that by 2030, most of our industries are on low-carbon technologies. I guess the last thing I'll say, and then I'll go to questions, because this is a wide topic. We would not put our money into highways. We get about $1.9 billion a year in cap and trade proceeds. That money all goes, because it's a regulatory fee and not a tax, has to be spent on lowering emissions. So $400 million is going into our auto sector to fund electric vehicle and autonomous vehicle research and deployment of technology. Massive deployment of electric charging. We subsidize electric vehicle purchases between $8,000 and $14,000. Almost all the electric vehicles, the Bolts, the i3s, the Teslas get the $14,000. Fiat Chrysler is now doing the Pacifica minivan or large van hybrid here now. That gets a $14,000 subsidy because of the nature and class of vehicle. We are putting a huge amount of money. People get very significant retrofits. So one of the reasons we don't expect to see that hockey stick is because people will be getting thousands of dollars to replace their home heating, cooling systems, batteries, geothermal. As a matter of fact, Enbridge, which just bought Spectra, is now the largest gas company in North America, is working with us because it takes about $25,000 to hook up natural gas to a home. A geothermal system only costs about $11,000 to $12,000 per unit, but people have to absorb the cost because there's no utility financing for that. So what Enbridge, which is now the largest gas company in North America, and I think probably very active in many of your states, they're going to be deploying geothermal systems alongside higher efficiency natural gas to use that utility model. And we expect that will have a very, very dramatic increase on reducing costs in addition to the subsidies. So we really designed the deployment of our revenues. And I would say that the two things in the design of our systems is massive reinvestment in buildings and transportation technology, because that's where all of our reductions have to come from. Massive investment. We have all of the petroleum and chemical refineries in Canada are in Ontario. There are 35 of them in Sarnia alone, right across the river from the United States. Well, Alberta and Saskatchewan extract oil. We refine oil. Nova Corporation, one of the largest, just put $250 million into decarbonizing their facility. We have eight border states: Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota, New York. We're doing very, very well competitively. We've had carbon pricing in place. As you know, almost all of those jurisdictions have similar economies to us. None of them have none of them have significant carbon pricing except New York. And we've been doing very, very well economically within this region. We have the highest level of GDP growth in Canada amongst all provinces right now. About when you put in the systems in BC and Alberta with Quebec and Ontario, about 85% of the Canadian economy now has a carbon price in place. So I can't imagine, you probably have some questions, so I'll stop it right there and see where you want to go with the questions, if that's okay.
Thank you very much, Minister. Questions from the committee? Yes. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. Minister, thank you so much for taking the time. I want to talk to you about Canada's natural resource use, because you mentioned mining earlier. And so when we look at your model, I think we need to look at apples to apples, right? Can you hear me okay?
Very clearly.
Thank you. Because I know that Canada has a much more aggressive, I'll say aggressive, policy on timber harvesting. We buy a lot of timber to build buildings here. You allow a number of mining practices.
Can't believe you did that. Nice job.
You can see where I was going, so cut that guy off.
She's known as the Power Ranger.
The Power Ranger?
That's his same nickname for me. Yeah.
Really? A movie, you know? It's coming.
Yeah. I'm sure I have nicknames over there, too, but nobody tell me what they are.
If I heard one, I'd tell you a little bit. Yeah,
let's stand Colleagues, let's just stand at ease for a moment as we get...
All right. I think we've overcome the failure.
Okay, we're back in order.
We're back in session.
Great.
Try not to break the machine this time.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair. Move on to the next question, maybe.
Yeah, that would I'm be sure.
Safer. Can you ask it? I'm sure Russian, so.
Well, thank you, Minister. I guess where I'm going is you talked about a lot of linking industries, and a lot of your industries up there are natural resource based. Are they not?
Mm-hmm. Well, manufacturing, we're the second largest financial services center after New York. Lots of resource industries, very heavy manufacturing, and we're the second largest financial services center in North America after New York. So 5 of the 10 largest banks, large insurance. It's a very diversified economy.
Correct. And so I guess we're, you allow natural gas exploration, fracking, mining, timber harvesting, and so forth. So I guess what I'm saying is when you look at the land use and natural resource use for your area and compare that to the restrictions in Oregon, for the same is where I wanted to compare apples to apples before we were cut off.
Okay. So we don't allow fracking. We're trying to reduce natural gas. We have certain natural gas support programs from rural and farm communities. We're the largest agricultural sector. We have the strongest endangered species legislation probably in North America, so we have a lot of habitat protected. We're a much more environmentally regulated jurisdiction than most of the American jurisdictions that we are aware of. We have a lot of, we're a very pro-free trade jurisdiction, but as you probably know, following softwood lumber, we have very, in spite of the North American Free Trade Agreement, we have very heavy tariffs on our softwood lumber, and it's limited. And when the housing market collapsed in 2008, 2009, we basically lost a lot of that. We have the problem in the age of electronics. Our pulp and paper industries have really suffered. So we now have, I heard one of you mentioning wood buildings. We now allow a six-story wood building. So we've been trying to provoke our domestic market. But I know from my conversations with members of your governor's staff over the years and meeting both with Republican and Democrat members of your House and Senate, we have many of the same frustrations that you have in market development, domestic security of supply, and the difficulties of international competition and a great deal of challenge with China given the amount of very inexpensive imports that come in for all kinds of products like that, including solar panels, lumber products, and things like that. So I was listening to your intervention earlier, and I would just say that you could have been a member of the Ontario legislature making that comment.
I'm gonna interject here because I have to leave in about 5 minutes, and I wanted to. Representative Brock Smith gets very close to another issue, which you talked about when we were all in California together, and that is the development of offsets and offsets markets. Can you explain why that has been important to Ontario and why you value it as either a part of or a complement to your involvement with WCI?
We allow about 8% of offsets. They have to meet international trade standards. That's important. It's important to our farm community. We're doing things like clean cow. We have a lot of livestock here. As you know, they're a very large source of methane. So we're doing a lot with forestry, and we're doing a lot with indigenous people, what you would call tribes or American Indians, we call them indigenous people or First Nations. And we do a lot of work with forestry offsets and ecosystems. One of the big challenges we have is we're going to face very major economic negative impacts, which we've started to model because our forests, our boreal forest, which is probably two-thirds of the surface area of our province, is going to warm up by 4 degrees Celsius in the summer and 8 degrees Celsius in the winter over the next few decades. That's about probably about 15 degrees Fahrenheit to about 22, 23 degrees Fahrenheit seasonally. It's mostly a black and white spruce forest. Those trees will die. So offsets are particularly important to us because we've got to figure out a way to get capital into our forest for ecological restoration. Because the boreal forest in Ontario alone absorbs the equivalent of probably four to five times all global human GHG emissions. So our forest here absorbs about 4 to 5 times all of the emissions produced every year by all human beings on the planet. So it's obviously all human, but also all other natural sources. So we've recognized that the health of our forests, the threat from pine beetles, the threat from droughts, our wetlands, and the massive amount of methane is that ecological restoration is really critical to us. It's not just anthropogenic. We see offsets and working with our forestry companies and our farmers, Ducks Unlimited, and a lot of our environmental and rural farm and angler and hunting groups who have been really stepped up, and they're not normally the typical environmental constituency that an environment minister would look to for support, but they've really stepped up, and that's been an important piece of it as well. We also are looking at other offsets that are not just voluntary, but are developmental, so that ones that are, that the government might buy to meet our obligations domestically wouldn't be as rigorous as some of the ones that would meet the standards, let's say, in California, but would have domestic application and would provide sufficient capital back into those communities to make it worth their while to get the reductions.
Thank you. I'm going to turn this over to Senator Dembro.
You could ask about moose. They're going too.
We don't have many of those anymore, sadly. We've had massive die-off of moose.
Representative Boone, I think you have a First Nation intervention there.
I do. Hello, Minister Murray. And can you see me?
I can, and it's nice to see you again. Sadly,
you see my friend.
Oh, you've got Oh.
Yes.
Oh, you have yes.
He is
Oregon
yours.
And Canada share the beaver.
The next time you come, he is yours. I know he's your Ontario mascot also, so he's he's waiting for you.
Oh, we share that, and some of the staff in the governor's office, I gave them a present, and we called the beaver OO, named after Oregon and Ontario. So it was also, you know, incredibly polite and fun. So,
but he's bigger, isn't he?
Beavers are a good symbol for politicians. They're earnest, hardworking folks who are relentless in the face of great opposition, which is what you need when you're dealing with climate change.
Yep. Well, welcome to Oregon, sort of.
Yeah. Representative Bruxner.
Welcome to the minority party in Oregon, Minister. That was supposed to be fun.
You seem to have done quite well nationally last election.
He's been abandoned by his...
I've been abandoned. I've lost my Republican colleagues. But I did want to comment...
I would remind you that cap and trade was an invention of the U.S. Republican Party, and some of your governors and congress members, both nationally, some of the states. And we spent a lot of time talking to Republicans in the U.S. when we were designing our system based on some of the original work that some of your colleagues did that we thought was very helpful. So nothing to be embarrassed about if you're a Republican. You guys kind of owned owned the podium on cap and trade in the early days.
Well, I could have gone without hearing that. but I did want to tell you, because you mentioned the six-story wood buildings, and if you can follow our cross-laminated timber project, the Frameworks Project out of Portland, which is an 18-story building that will be constructed purely with CLTs and advanced wood products, then the exciting thing about it is we're not only sequestering carbon in that building, but writing the code, the building codes that are necessary to utilize these wood products in much larger buildings, and the testing that has gone on through the process that shows that it's more seismically resilient. Sorry, my aggregate folks aren't here, are they? No. And of course, resists fire better than steel. So, and I don't have any steel workers in my district, so you're out of luck. So, but it's a very exciting project, and we just moved it out of economic development and trade earlier this week. So.
Well,
that would be something great to work on together.
Colleagues, I think we're going to have to move on. We have one more call, yes, to Michael Gibbs in California. So, Glenn, thank you very much for making time. This has been very helpful. If we could go on for another half hour, I'm sure we could get Representative Brock Smith as a co-sponsor of the bill. But we'll get there.
I guess the last thing I would say, I think, if I could just leave you with one thought, I think all of us in Canada, all of the provinces, even those that have a more traditional tax system, would argue the sooner we have a carbon pricing cap and trade system or some market system across North America, leakage and competitive issues go away, and the North American economy becomes much more strongly positioned against Europe and China, where we think our real competition is. So we would love to work with you on bilaterally on forests, on market developments, and thank you very much for your friendship. We consider you great allies and great friends. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. And actually, your last comment reminded me, just if I could ask you one more question, and that's, it came up last week where one of our members asked why would what would be the interest of California or Quebec or Ontario of having Oregon join? You know, what is the upside? We're a little state. You know, what, I mean, how does, you know, what we bring to the table, how would that help you all?
Well, I'd answer that with three quick sentences. One, for small jurisdictions, it's important for price stability. Nova Scotia, which is one of our smallest provinces, only 800,000 people, looked at models. They just decided on cap and trade. New Brunswick, who are expecting similarly. It helps keep price down. It helps give flexibility for businesses to transition. Well, number two is the further north you go, the more you're experiencing the impacts of climate change. We're warming at twice the rate you are. We need everybody on board, and it's often the smaller jurisdictions that are more consequential in the international discussions. And if you're a state or a province with a great bounty of natural resources, of rivers and streams and forests, I think you come to quickly understand that it's so frustrating watching your inheritance and your, the pride of your country and your people disappearing before you. And second, it's been darn good for our economy. Our economy is doing really, really well. And we see a, we've seen a huge economic upswing and upside to decarbonizing our economy, and I think most jurisdictions have. And we're finding, whether you're a small or large jurisdiction, it's just the more successful way to go. You get better jobs, you're attracting lower new technologies, you're retrofitting every building, which is probably the biggest job creation project we've ever had, because, and you're leaving everyone with a more affordable home, cars, getting people to drive cars, they don't have to pay for gas at the pump. It really reduces the structural costs in transportation and buildings and energy. We're seeing real cost reductions. So for all of those good reasons, those three, I would suggest it's a good thing, large or small, linking keeps you in a good market, helps give you some protection and stability for your business.
So I was just going to say, Deb forgot to ask you to come to Portland for our PENWAR conference with our other Canadian provinces and this summer. So
he's yours if you come and get him.
I'm in California the last week of April, and if there's an invitation to Oregon, it is one of my favorite places. I actually would like to retire to Portland one day. I think it's the most beautiful city in North America. It's just gorgeous.
You're rising in my esteem with every moment, Minister.
The Southern Oregon coast is much better, man.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you so much, my friends. You take care.
Yeah.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Hello, Michael. This is Michael Dembrow in Oregon. Thank you for your patience.
No problem. Happy to be with you.
Okay. So we've asked you to join us. We just heard from Minister Murray about the process that they used in Ontario for deciding to join the WCI. And last week, we as a joint group, House and Senate, we heard about, we had a kind of carbon markets 101, and just wanted to follow up on that a little bit tonight with a sense of where things are in Ontario, where things are in California. So I don't know if you had remarks you wanted to make, but they would be most welcome.
Sure, thanks, and thank you, and happy to be with you and happy to make some opening remarks, and then to go ahead and answer any questions or have a discussion with you. I have been able to follow the presentations and discussion that has come before. It's great to see Minister Murray and be reminded of our collaboration and friendly competition for leadership in this area. And we welcome their kickoff of their program and their first auction, which is starting up. What I wanted to share with you is a little bit of our experience having run our program now since 2013, and what we have seen and some some of the lessons we have learned to actually run the program. So I'll get a little bit into some of the details, but I'll try to sort of keep things moving. I know it's a late hour here, and get to some questions. We started our program in 2013. So this was during the recovery from the Great Recession that we all went through. It's also, as we've experienced here in the West, the drought. Despite those challenges, the recession and the drought, the California economy has thrived and is rebounding well. We still have work to do to recover from the drought, particularly in our agriculture sector, but we're hopeful that our rainy winter will bring us some relief. I wanted to just start with a couple of graphs that you may have in front of you. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. And audience, they are on our legislative system.
Okay, good. Just a quick context of what we're dealing with. The pie chart on the left is our greenhouse gas emissions inventory, which shows that transportation and industrial emissions are our two largest sources of emissions. Our electricity sector emissions are small and declining as a result of our various policies. And our, of course, residential and commercial buildings are important sources as well. If you move over to the middle graph, you can see the top line there, which is our greenhouse gas emissions over time for the whole state. That's our emissions inventory. And you see 2009 from the recession, that big drop there. That was a pattern, that decline was seen really across the country during the recession. As we started to recover from the recession, you'll see our emissions started to go up a little bit, but as our program started to kick in, the emissions started to decline, and that's really the effect of our programs. While this is all happening, to go over to the right-hand side, you see what was happening with our economy, and this is our state output, our GDP, and you see again the dip in the top line there, the dip in the recession, but then pretty robust growth, really outpacing the nation as a whole in our economy. So as we were putting our program in place, as we were recovering from the recession, and as we were dealing with the drought, all of those things, we were able to continue to grow our economy. So we think that, as Minister Murray explained, I think very effectively, that our ability to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions while promoting growth in our economy is working out quite well. So let's turn to the cap and trade program itself. The program is supported by a rigorous emissions reporting. We have about 800 reporting entities, of which 350 have large enough emissions to be covered by the cap and trade program. So that's 350 facilities and entities in the program. The overall cap declined by about 3.5% per year through 2020, which will keep the state under our 2020 emissions target, which is to return to 1990 emissions levels by 2020. I'd like to point out that we've had three compliance events. These events are when the facilities that are covered by the cap and trade program must turn in their allowances and offset credits to cover their emissions. And we've had virtually 100% compliance at all three events. Only one facility, which was a modest-sized cogeneration plant, had a catastrophic accident in 2013 and stopped operating. It was only able to partially comply, but all of the facilities supplied 100% at the first three compliance events, which is a great way for the program I would like to spend a couple minutes on the effort that we put in to try to minimize leakage in the industrial sector. It's a topic that, of course, comes up whenever you approach the prospects of carbon pricing. We similarly looked at different systems and decided on cap and trade and designed the program jointly through the Western Climate Initiative. And leakage was an area that got a lot of attention. It sounds like you've also focused a lot on the questions of leakage. So what we've done is to prevent leakage and to continue and grow our industrial sector and our economy while reducing emissions, we decided that we will give free allowances to industrial emitters in a certain way. And the way we do that is we give free allowances based on an emissions intensity benchmark for each industrial sector. So the benchmark is measured in emissions per unit of product produced. So it's a benchmark. And we started the benchmark off in 2013, when we started, at 90% of the average for California facilities. So at this benchmark level where they get free allowances, the most efficient facilities get close to all the allowances they need, and in some cases a little extra that they could sell, while the less efficient facilities were a little short, and they found they needed to improve to compete. Now, the free allocation declines each year with the cap, and this keeps the incentive in place to reduce emissions. But how does this actually help prevent leakage? Well, there's another feature that I really need to emphasize, and that is that the amount of free allowances is adjusted based on the actual production at each facility. Well, let me just repeat that. The free allowances are adjusted based on the actual production at the facility. So remembering that the benchmark is in emissions per unit output, if you have more production, then you get more free allowances. This way, the free allocation accommodates growth at the facilities. So if you invest in your facility, you improve its efficiency, and you produce more output, you get more free allowances because the benchmark is tied to the amount of output you're producing. And we're finding that this is working out pretty well for our manufacturing sector. Manufacturing employment in the state is up since the program started covering emissions in 2013. Some facilities have reduced their emissions below their free allocation and are using their extra allowances to sell and help fund their investments in their facilities. As Ms. Shaveri said, even our cement plants are finding that they're making out well and can improve their emissions intensity and work well under the program. And from this experience, we have found no evidence that the cap and trade program has been any sort of drag on the economy or the manufacturing sector. Rather, the economy is continuing to thrive and outpace the nation as a whole. So we think this is a good experience. We think this is an approach that's worth looking at and evaluating. We're always, of course, trying to improve and make sure that we're doing the best we can and make tweaks to it, and so we continue to analyze it as well. I would like to turn to auctions and say a few words about that. Allowances that are not provided for free to industry are auctioned. And actually, they're auctioned in two sets at the same auction, but they come from two places. A portion of the allowances are provided to electricity and natural gas distribution utilities. And those allowances are consigned to the auction and sold on their behalf. And those utilities have received about $4 billion so far in auction revenue. And the utilities return those dollars to their ratepayers in the form of a climate credit. So you may have heard about this in the Cap and Trade 101, but this credit, which appears on customer bills twice a year, covers any increase in costs in the electric sector due to the program. So that's really in the form of a direct rebate to electricity and natural gas customers. And that's a pretty big number. That's about $4 billion. The state also sells allowances and gets proceeds from those into the state, and that's been about $4.4 billion to date. And so you see that the sort of direct credit to the utility customers is almost half the total of the auctioned allowances, the other half coming to the state. And that half goes into a dedicated fund that we call the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. Monies in that fund are appropriated by the legislature. as part of the annual budget process. We at the Air Resources Board do not control those monies. The Department of Finance prepares a three-year investment plan, which helps inform the legislative budget process, but it's really under the control of the budget process, where the legislature enacts the budget and is signed by the governor. Perhaps as an aside, I'll just mention that California does not use auction proceeds to run the climate program in California. Rather, we have a separate fee that's collected that covers the cost, not just of cap and trade, but the entire climate program, including activities by other agencies. And that fee is paid by large emitters and is about 12 cents per metric ton, and it's paid each year. So that's a relatively small amount per ton, but raises enough money to run the program. So that does not come out of the auction proceeds. So California has decided to invest its auction proceeds in multiple ways, not that different really from what Minister Murray described. A lot goes into transportation, affordable housing, particularly near transportation hubs, vehicle rebates and charging stations for non-emitting, for electric vehicles, low-income weatherization, and the like. It's also worth pointing out that in California, part of a sort of just transition type of investment, about a third of the state's proceeds must be invested in disadvantaged communities, and to date about half has been invested in projects that benefit those communities. So that's a little bit about how the auction proceeds are reinvested back into the state. I would like also just to give my perspective a little bit on the idea of linking programs. I think California's experience has shown that you can use a cap and trade program to reduce emissions while protecting the economy. And linking enables smaller jurisdictions with smaller economies to use this tool. So California, along with Quebec and Ontario, offer the opportunity for jurisdictions with compatible programs to link. And when linked, what that means is that the compliance instruments from each program are tradable and usable among the linked programs. So linking raises a couple questions, and I'll just try to answer a couple here, including what would Oregon need to agree to link, and how much independence would a state like Oregon get to keep if it linked? Well, a couple things of note. In each jurisdiction that links, that jurisdiction gets to decide how it wants to allocate its allowances. I've described a little bit about how California does it, but Oregon may want to do something similar or perhaps something different, and that's entirely up to you. Also, if Oregon decides to auction allowances, it would be entirely up to Oregon to decide how to use its auction proceeds. So California has some constitutional limitations on how auction proceeds can be used, and Oregon will have its constraints, and possibly different priorities for how to invest those funds. So again, that's entirely up to the jurisdiction. So Oregon, for example, would decide both how to allocate its allowances, how to use auction proceeds, which is really describing the distributional aspects of the program, and that entirely remains at your discretion. But what would Oregon need to agree to? So where do things really need to be the same across link programs? Well, there's a couple things I think worth pointing out, and I'll mention them here. First, any link program would need to be at least as ambitious or stringent as the California program, because California has a statute that prohibits us from linking with a less stringent program. And the other primary area is really because allowances are traded across programs in a market, it's critical that all the linked programs have the same identical market rules. There's a variety of rules. I can go into them in more detail if you like. I'll just mention a couple. One is that it's important that all the programs have the same floor price for selling allowances at auction. This must be identical. And second, there's a limit on the allowances that can be held by any single entity, a limit on how many they can own. The limit is there to prevent any one entity from being able to exert market power, try to corner the market on allowances or some such thing. So all the linked jurisdictions really need to have the same market rules. It's also worth noting that if Oregon decides to issue offset credits, that the offsets need to meet the same specifications that we've all adopted to ensure that they are additional and real, permanent, verifiable, and enforceable. So you might also ask, how would Oregon companies fare in the market for allowances? Would they be able to compete well with the participants in Ontario and Quebec? And I think a couple things I could just mention. In California and Ontario, the largest participants are refineries and natural gas distribution companies. In the overall program, there aren't too many of those. Most of the program participants, and there are several hundred of them, are mid-sized facilities, including food processors, manufacturers, and others. And I would expect that Oregon companies would be similar to those and would participate alongside them in the LINK program. Finally, I'd like just to put in a plug for the Western Climate Initiative Incorporated, or WCI Inc. It's a nonprofit company that provides program infrastructure to the LINK program, including California, Ontario, and Quebec. So what that means is that if Oregon were to join, they could use the existing infrastructure and would not need to invent anything from scratch. So I'll just close by saying a little bit about our plans for post-2020. The states adopted a goal to reduce emissions to 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. We released a draft of our post-2020 cap and trade program regulation and are working on a refined proposal, which will be released soon. Our legislature and governor are working together on legislation for the post-2020 program. The governor has said that he would like to get a two-thirds vote on this legislation, which would eliminate any uncertainty associated with ARB's or authority to auction allowances. And that's important because that's been challenged in court. It's not yet been decided by the court, but a two-thirds vote would resolve that issue. Legislative action is anticipated by June, and the next fiscal year budget is completed. So that's the sort of update from California on what we've actually experienced as we've gone through the program and since we've started it in 2013. I'm happy to take any questions.
Michael, thank you very much. I was very cogent, and I don't know, this is actually starting to make sense to me, which is a little scary. But Senator Roblin had a question.
Yeah, a couple, actually. The first one has to do with, have you done, because your carbon price has been pretty stable, have you done any modeling out to 2050 with your continued increase in getting your lower emissions? Have you done any modeling that shows what that price goes to out to 2050?
So yes, we are in the process of doing that now for our post-2020 program. The modeling focuses on the period through 2030, but actually runs it out through 2050. So our 2030 target is 40% below 1990 levels, and our 2050 target is 80% below. What we see in the post-2030 period is the potential for increased allowance prices. But I would say that, and I think you touched on this before when you were talking with the first group who testified before you, that as you get further and further out into the future, the range of uncertainty, the band of uncertainty, really gets large, from technologies to fossil fuel prices to population and other economic growth issues. And so when we're looking at how to best design our program to reach our 2030 goal, the 2050 performance is important context, but it's not really the defining feature of our decision making. You want to make investments that do not dead end in 2030 and then need to restart to do something different by 2050. So that's important. But if you're on the right trajectory, to get to 2030 in an affordable way with reliably across across a range of uncertainty within the context of getting to 2050, we think that works well.
Okay. And you have a follow-up?
Yeah, my other one has to do with different sources of power. What percentage of your electricity is produced through nuclear?
Yes. So California until recently had two nuclear plants. San Onofre recently closed, and so that is no longer operating, which leaves Diablo Canyon as the sole remaining nuclear facility in the state of California, and that, if I remember correctly, is about 6% of our power. PG&E is the primary owner-operator of that facility and has announced that they will not be renewing the license for that facility, which expires in 2025, I believe. I have that correct. And so that will go offline. So that will leave no nuclear power remaining in California. I should point out that several California utilities own a portion of Palo Verde in Arizona, and so we do get power from there, although that's not a significant overall source in the state.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I have one question about your modeling that you talked about. Did your modeling include offsets and banking allowances?
So we've done, I've been involved in doing modeling of our cap and trade program since 2007. And we've done multiple rounds using probably six different modeling systems with a variety of different approaches at various levels of granularity, including very granular up to sort of the high level type that had been described earlier today. And in all of them, we've tried to evaluate and understand what the implications of these different fine flexibility features, as we call them, and those would include banking, multi-year compliance periods, and offsets, for example. And we find that those are particularly important to try to keep the program affordable. So when we did our analysis with and without offsets, we found that that had a large impact on what allowance prices would be. When we did it with and without banking, we found particularly in sort of the mid-period of our analysis, what we were seeing is that if you allow banking, you get more early reductions in the early years of your program when there's more low-hanging fruit still there, right? So people reduce their emissions early, and then they bank those allowances and then use them a little bit later in the program when things start getting more expensive. And that tends to smooth out the curve. So, for example, you saw that curve in the prior presentation where it sort of goes up and comes down and goes up again. With banking, that would smooth out. You'd see a little bit different, I think, performance there. We also think that the multi-year compliance period is important. Here we are in the West with some hydropower dependency throughout our states. And we know how that fluctuates from year to year, and we don't want to get stuck with a single year that's a bad hydro year and higher emissions and higher costs. So, having a multi-year compliance period is helpful for that. And frankly, linking with others like Quebec and Ontario is also helpful for that because it might be dry here, but not dry there. You know, that sort of thing. And so having more diversity, across jurisdictions and sources also helps to smooth out what would otherwise be these lumpy things like a low hydro year. So that we found in our analysis that those were all important.
Thank you. Michael, as we wrap up now, and I think we've got to bring this to an end, clearly you have a lot of experience down there that we can learn from. But let me ask you, just in closing, What last bit of advice do you have for us as we embark on this decision-making process that we're in?
Well, perhaps it's presumptuous of me to give too much advice to a fellow legislative body. I think that the idea that decarbonizing our economies is an opportunity and not just a cost is, I think, a realization that we've come to. When we do the analysis in advance, as we did in 2008, 2010, and now, again, these past 2 years, we find that the range of impact on the economy from the program as it's designed and as it operates is really quite small. Even in the presentation you heard before, the 0.4% impact on GDP, some 20 years from now, that's if your economy is growing at even 1% a year, pretty slow growth. That just means you reach the same point 6 months later. So these are really small differences. And if you can design the program well and really attract investment and put your economy on a firmer, more efficient footing, and I think Minister Murray described this well, you really have an opportunity not just to avoid the downside, but to really create much more upside than I think any of our analysis has shown to date. And I think that's what we're starting to see. I think that's a real opportunity that's out there. The other thing I would suggest is, again, as a smaller economy, and really virtually every state in North America, every province in North America, outside of maybe California and Texas, which isn't going to do this, it does not have an economy that's large enough and diverse enough to do it on its own. It really needs to link. And so I would suggest that you really look hard at linking and who you want to link with, and why you want to link with them and what you want to get out of that, because I think that really offers an opportunity to use this type of program to your benefit, which you would not otherwise be able to do on your own. So I really think that should really seriously be part of the discussion. So I'll just stop there.
Okay. Michael, thank you very much. I'm sure we know where to find you if we have further questions.
Okay,
great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, colleagues, any last questions or comments? I'll just say that the plans, again, for next week are that we're going to focus on the impacts and opportunities of carbon pricing on rural economies and environmental justice communities. So it should be very interesting. Okay, so with that, Senate Committee, we are adjourned.
We have more House members.
House Committee.
We have more House members.
House Committee.